Hello, I'm Joe B. Today is February 16, 2025 at the Nassau Intergroup office, and I will be interviewing Marty Kay. This audio recording will be reproduced and remain in the custody of Nassau General Service Archives in the Nassau County, New York area. As such, will not be reproduced for other uses. In the interest of anonymity, we ask that no last names be stated. Do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes.
So before AA, please tell me a little bit about your life before you found AA, when and where you were born. What kind of childhood did you have?
Well, it was a Jewish family in the middle of Canarsie, Brooklyn. And I was always uncomfortable in my own skin. You know, I was always, you know, either feeling like I didn't belong to my family. I had questions to my parents that, looking back now, not knowing at that time, but in AA we look backwards at things. And also there were things, my parents seemed to always care about everyone else rather than me, and we were compared to other cousins and educational, sports, a lot of criticism. And that was, you know, so.
How did you start drinking?
Okay, it was either a Friday or Saturday night, and we shared a quart of Colt 45 with two other guys on our banana bikes. We're in the lots with those weeds. There's a path that's always cut out, you know, to wander in. And, yeah, I loved it. The moisture on the bottle, on the back of it. I didn't like the taste. Do you hear that in AA? I hated, you know, I think my father and mother gave me little sips here and there, but that wasn't my first drunk. And that was my first drunk.
Wow.
And I always say I wasn't 13 yet because I'm in December. So that was another inadequacy. I felt like I was the smallest all the time, shortest, and I had to be up front. And it made me self-conscious, like in a batter's box, anything, a basketball. If I was open completely in like 6th or 7th grade, I missed it. That was wide open. I got fear. I had a lot of fear, not knowing. Knowing we didn't talk about things in my house. So when you're always yelled at, you don't trust talking. Okay.
So when did you know you had hit bottom?
Well, in 1984, there was a friend that sobered up. And he gave us some pamphlets, and we never read them. And I was hanging out at the school park, because we lived near a school park in Canarsie. And that's where he used to come by. And then in 1985, December, I had to ask him, where did he go? And it was Brunswick Hospital. For the first time, I understood now, you know, what the problem was. And some man in there did talk to me. He was in Bensonhurst, and I was in Canarsie. And he shared Reggie T, and he was sharing me how, like, I'm a liar, and like you know about relapsing,
yeah.
And he told me how much he relapsed, and I said to myself, that's never gonna happen to me. So my 20 days were up, and I had this overwhelming, oh my God, I'm. Two things I heard, Joe, in the speakers coming to the hospital, was one is once I start drinking, I'll have no control over the amount I take, and the second thing is I needed defense between me and that drink. So my father came, not even thinking that he left work to love me and come to pick me up out in Amityville from Canarsie. Plus he left the business. You know, he was a workaholic, my father. And anyway, I said to the doctor, if I leave, I'm going to drink against my own will. I never said that before. anyway, Reggie did pick me up, and I did drink an hour later. From the ride from South Oaks over to a place, you know, that I could get the ease and comfort that comes at once from taking a drink. So I relapsed, but I kept coming.
So when did you first hear of AA and from what source?
Oh, well, my friend Gary Kay, I owe a debt to, like Dr. Bob says. You know, I take out a little insurance against the slip, but the man who passed it on to me. I want to share something in my first, you know, like 30 days at the rehab. There was another fellowships. I was in Port Jervis, New York, and I did this man wrong in my relapse. We had set Gary Kay up outside the house. He had a Monte Carlo to sell. We used to, you know, hang out for many, many years as friends. Maybe we, you know, hung out with different people. We started selling newspapers for the Daily News. And we met that way. So we knew we were neighbors, and we would pay our route money that we collected, and I knew Gary, right? And then, so now he's sober and clean, and we set him up outside my house when he came in, and I signed the car note and had the money. And right away, I had no idea what they were going to do to him, but I knew they were waiting to take the money from him. And they chipped his tooth with a little slap hammer. Now I'm in the rehab, speed it up. Now this is 1987, of April 25th, 1987 is my sober date. I don't know, like within 2 weeks, he came and he was going to take, what do they call it, a walkthrough of the Stevensville Hotel in Swan Lake. And they told me he was there. But I knew. I just had a feeling I didn't have to run anymore. But I didn't know why he came. But I knew what I did to him. And you know what? He said, Marty, we sat in a room. They asked me, do you mind? They're friends here. So first he said he had a banquet ticket for me to come and sit with him up front. Now, I was relapsing, you know. So anyway, he goes to me, Marty, I want to share with you. He goes, Marty, I forgive you for what you did that day in front of your house, he says. And that's all we're going to say about that. He says, all right, I just want to tell you, I'm offering you an olive branch. I'm taking the steps. I'm doing my ninth step with you, and I'm forgiving you. And that was a good tone for my recovery. And I did go to the Stevensville Hotel, you know, and was full of self-conscious all the time, you know, and inadequate, insecure. But I survived, you know, that one day. The rehab gave me a pass for that day. I forget how I got there and how I got back. But it was good, you know, to be part. I was born to a family, but I joined a spiritual family, AA. But at that time, I was just in the rehab. So you go to meetings. We didn't go outside yet to other meetings in the other towns. And that's it. So my first year, when I had 87 days, I went home to Canarsie. And I went right to the Canarsie group. I forget what nights of the week they met. And they said to me, Marty, welcome back. We've been praying for you, the opening prayer and the closing prayer. And they said, also, next week we're going to teach you how to make coffee. And, the next week they gave me the key. I didn't have the key to my parents' house, Joe. I wouldn't blame them for not trusting me. I couldn't trust myself. But sponsorship was important. I joined that home group. And so started counting days and got commitments. And I built a network and became as willing as a dog could be.
Can you tell me about your early sobriety, your work through the steps, and the problems you had in the first days of learning the AA way?
I would say, you know, I was working for my father again, and they used to give out the phone numbers. And so I had the phone numbers now, but I never used them before. And this day, I don't know, somewhere about 4 months, let's just say around 4 months sobriety, and all of a sudden I saw a wicker basket with capsules, you know, and I had the thought of picking them up and looking at them. And I didn't. It was just a thought. And I made the phone calls. And the one man I got, so my early recovery, he said, Marty, the most normal thing you're supposed to be thinking about is drinking or doing other things. And he goes, Marty, am I going to see you at the meeting tonight? So they said there were two times you go to a meeting. But so there is a struggle. So that was that. I had two brothers that were active, you know, and sometimes my father would ask me to take them to the meetings. And I didn't have a driver's license, but he gave me the car. Can you imagine? Because it was working. They saw, you know, that there was a difference in my recovery. So I had a sponsor that I had in the rehab because I was up there, and then I was in a sober house, and 87 days I left. At 90, 3 days later, I got on the bus because I was so self-centered. I only thought about me. I never still gave to the business, but I knew I came to AA to stop drinking, and I didn't know about giving yet. So I go up to the rehab, and I speak in 90 days. So it was about me. And any other commitments I got in my first year, I really didn't care about work. There was meetings around the clock in Manhattan. That's mostly where the business was. And all I could think about is, wow, man, people want me to speak at this meeting, come back. And, you know, there was different ones in the city. Mustard Seed, downtown 14th Street, Perry Street, 79th Street. Then there was the 96th Street, the West 90th. And so I loved it. It filled the void. You know, you don't realize. But I did get a second sponsor. And back then, you know, it didn't matter. You know, you called him. You did. You got his voicemail. He got mad that you didn't get him because you're self-centered. And so leave a message. And probably would beep, you know, because you went on too long. But I had a void. I had an emptiness in me that just not only... So, you know, the early recovery for me, you know, I was still sick. You know, I just had a lot of baggage, you know, I would say. And so then, you know, we did the steps slow, the first 2-3 with Brian M. I call him Brian M. And my sponsor did tell me upstate, Marty, you're so not well. Because you could see my brain was always thinking, the rippling in the forehead. He said, I'm not going to sponsor you anymore. After like a few days, I want you to call me. But you need to get a sponsor, you can see. And because I had trust issues. I wasn't going to just raise my hand and trust everybody in the meetings. I needed to begin one-on-one with someone. So sponsorship was that way. I didn't feel like anything I told them was like I'm the sickest person in the world. But in front of a room, because I was conscious, you know, I would lay a bomb and I would say, I really said that. It was like overwhelming to talk about the truth. You know, uncomfortable at that point in my recovery to give it to others. Maybe one-on-one in a diner. Those were the diner meetings too. You know, I'd start to tuck my head out and, you know, share some sick dereliction or thoughts.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. How many groups of meetings were in existence?
Brooklyn had plenty of meetings. There was no excuse not to have a meeting. Plus, I had a New York intergroup five-borough meeting list that I carried in my fanny pack. Besides, I carried also in that fanny pack, I have my 12 and 12 still. That's a pocket-sized one. Because I have that original. And the 24-hour day book, which I don't have anymore. But I needed everything I could to be on the trains with other people. I always still felt different, awkward. You know, the duck on the flapping on the bottom of the water kind of thing, you know. So, and then if I felt I saw someone who was from my past, was I going to ignore them? Was I going to, you know. So my brothers did say to me on the trains or walking, or they saw me on the bus. We had to take a bus into the train station. That, oh, Marty, everybody thinks you're like, you know, who you think you are now. But I had to avoid them. I had to. One is I didn't want to talk to them and put them down. And, you know, and I didn't feel like if I talked to them, I was tempted. Because most people did, you know, oh, where you going to get high, Marty? You know, I want to share this with you. In the sober house that I went to in Middletown, New York, it was called the Top of the Hill Group. They met at 12. And I stopped going to meetings in this Christian sober house. But the bar next door, everybody said that you could return your white chip. Then there was a poker chip that you got. And they said, I still have my poker chip. I still have my original surrender chip in the rehab. And they said if you went to the bar that was right next to the sober house, they'll give you a drink. They think you got some money now.
Right.
And they said it's still, some places still talk about that. That's a standard serious joke. They don't mind. They know once you start drinking, you can't stop.
Deadly.
Yeah.
Can you recall the formats used at some of these early meetings? How were they run?
Most of the time we didn't say the serenity prayer at the beginning, and then they would say we're starting the meeting. The other thing for me, you remind me, not just the format, the men were sniffed me out, the men. And one time they said to me, they showed me the shades, and they showed me that God was right in the center of the shades. Like if I was aiming, that's my life. You know, so they were like, you know, it's not so easy to come in here. You could have God in your life. And I'm trying to think what the second one was. But whatever that is, it might come to me. But there were two things. One about the shades they pointed at. Oh, and the other one was this. When we say how it works, when we read it, it talks about that's the first prayer. Even if we open up the meeting with a prayer. How it works is we asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took. So they were showing me it was the steps. You know, which isn't so easy for a mental defect.
When was AA started in your town or area? How often were meetings held? Who were some of the people playing important roles in the formation of the new groups? What else do you know about the growth of AA during that period of time?
Well, now being the archivist, Frank C. Was an original member of the Canarsie group. I know it's got to go to the 60s because the Link started. That's the newsletter for the scene, and he was the editor of that first Link. He also became a delegate, which no one ever talked about. I don't even know what, you know, if we ever talked about the General Service Conference. Or, I know it busy me, but my brain was busy. So, you know, I would just absorb what I could absorb, you know, and piecemeal. And so I just found a memorial in the link for Frank. I forget what year that was that he passed away. He was the first. So the group has roots in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, definitely. Early roots, Brooklyn.
I know you before, you actually did mention a few individuals that were prominent. Is there anybody else that you can think of off the top of your head that was prominent in your sobriety?
Well, it was all my sponsors, you know, like I said, you know, really. And I didn't just, they weren't just my sponsor. After Brian M., there was a guy, Alan W., and we had a relationship for a while, and he was the best man at my wedding. You know, I got married in 1992 and 93, and he lives out in South Jersey now. And so there was, you know, and the friends I built the network with. I say be willing. Sponsor, sponsee, home group, commitment, and network. So my network early on were some men. Two or three of them had family businesses. It just happened to be, you know, my father, you know, owned a business. And we met. There were five of us. So most of the time we were talking about what meeting we were going to, or if we were already in Manhattan and they stayed at St. Mark's. St. Mark's place had between 2nd and 30th Avenue, had meetings around the clock and more than one fellowship. And that meeting's still in existence. It's now in Chinatown because it turned into a condo I don't know how many years ago. So, yeah, that's important too. And as that network dissipated and you get sponsees and, your friends, they do become your friend and you hang out. And, yeah, this was very interesting. Network. The network could change. But you need to have others in AA, the we, not only a home group. And now people don't go to the diners as much, you know, the diner thing. The 20 minutes, 2020 club, right? Yeah. And I didn't want to say yes to diners at the beginning. I had no money, you know, and I was an isolated too. So you kind of have habits. But people would, I went. And it was, you know, you saw another aspect of people's lives. Not to, meetings, we stay focused. We have no opinion on outside issues, and it's serious recovery. But then there was other things. They talked about retreats. They talked, become as open as the dying could be, where I'm always saying no at first. Even to commitments, Marty Want, I liked my first instinct, not anymore, was to say no because of fear, you know. And even sometimes if there was a softball or come to someone's house, a lot of times my first instinct was say no, but as I progressed, I realized I called them up, days in advance. I have this habit of saying no, and I'm not weird or strange, but can I come over and spend, holidays people had you over, whether it's Jewish holidays. It's still not my strong suit, social instinct, One-on-one's great like this.
How were new members contacted? What kinds of 12-step work were going on? Are there any 12-step antidotes that stick out in your mind that you'd care to share?
Oh, wow. Well, in the kitchen at my first meeting, I love this. They said to me, they welcomed me back because anyway, and they said, Marty, alcoholics are going to come into the kitchen and some are going to be drunk. And they talked about the solution, that they had the solution for them. We're solution-oriented. I don't know if that was the term, as the big book term. But so we work with alcoholics. And they actually, I went on 12-step calls with them. And they had alcohol in the trunk. Because some people had to get into, the Bedford Avenue sobering station. And if they were on substances, then they have alcohol on their breath. So they had alcohol. And they were, guys that the wife had called AA. And it's true.
So that was great, yeah.
Would you tell me about your experiences sponsoring others?
The first one who asked me, I didn't say yes. I just told him I got to get back to my sponsor. But when I talked to my sponsor, being responsible for someone else's life, he had to explain to me. You have to start somewhere. And someone wants what you have. You want what I have, so stuff like that. So I worked with a lot of fear about it, feeling. Like you have to be perfect. All of a sudden, you're not perfect. But and I wasn't a good listener. I like to talk. So, sponsor people, is too ears to listen. That was another one. I want to share something with you. My mother, when I was in my teen years, had said to me that listening silent have the same letters, but they're spelled different. I didn't listen. I just, you know, my mother knew that, you know. But anyway, I came to AA, and when you hear that, listen to learn, it's almost like I was like, where's my mother? I never heard it like that, listen to learn and learn to listen. But I remember my mother, you know, was trying to tell me.
Nice acronym. Unity. How did early AAs treat newcomers? You kind of covered on that a little bit before. How did your group treat constant slippers?
Well, like they did with me. You know, when I came in, the compassion. I remember they were people tough. Don't get me wrong, Joe. And even if I came back, they were still tough. But, you know, I still was a sensitive. I would bristle with antagonism. I have a hypersensitivity. So I didn't need to have them in my life. I needed the ones who were going to be loving and soft. And, you know, sometimes they bought my bullet. And then, but the tough guys, they knew it. They saw me a mile away. So I realized that. That's their strength. They're not really rough.
How did they treat 13-steppers? How were people wishing to talk about multiple addictions during your meetings addressed? And how about non-alcoholic drug addicts walking in off the street for their first meeting?
So I was an easy case because when I went to the other fellowship, I announced myself, and my sponsees and friends saw that. My other my network, those few guys, when we went to AA, we were alcoholics. You know, it wasn't because we somehow it was natural for us. We didn't have a struggle, a temper towards abiding, you know, or conforming. So for us, I don't really know about others if, you know, they would talk to on the side about traditions or, you know, welcome here. I don't really recall that. It was easy for me wherever I went. I had all these long names of people, you know, I don't hear that too much anymore. Yeah.
Can you talk about all the differences that led to new groups being formed in your area?
Most of the AA meetings, my home group moved from the building they were on, Conklin and 92nd. They didn't move far, and I was surprised. I think I had 35 years, I'm coming up on 38. But whatever amount of time it was, I took a whole bunch of guys because I saw it was at a different church. And it was very small, and they changed the name. I knew it didn't say Canarsie Group. They call it Miracles of Recovery. And the strange thing was, at the end of the meeting, they asked if you wanted to go upstairs for prayer, because the pastor was also one of us. But I thought that was a little. So the meeting's come a long way, you know, from 100 people in the room smoking. Oh, forget about it. I wasn't a smoker. You know, I didn't make coffee. I didn't even drink coffee. I remember when my sponsor said, Marty, if they don't like your coffee, talk to me. He said, Marty, if they don't like your coffee, you know where to tell them to go. I said, no, I'll tell them you to go talk to you, and you tell them where to go, because I don't have that kind of, I don't do that kind of stuff. I got myself in trouble with my mouth.
What controversies over issues addressed in the traditions can you recall people wrestling with?
Well, the smoking I just talked about, that right. Was, you know, we were beset by problems, you know, like it says in second edition, you know, could these erstwhile alcoholics, you couldn't have a half a smoking room, you know, but I don't remember if Canarsie Group it was one of those groups that didn't want to, you know, have trouble with the, but it was at that time, groups were very mad about smoking, you know. I mean, you can't go to a meeting and not breathe. And it was a law. The laws of the land don't stop at the doors of AA. So, you know, but it wasn't like, so the fourth tradition, you know, each group is autonomous, but this was something that would affect other groups as a whole. So now that smoking is not an issue, but that was a struggle, I remember. We're defiant people, you know, we're childish and grandiose and... psychiatrist said it.
What kind of relationship did AA in your area have with local authorities? How has that changed since you sobered up?
I was amazed how many officers, not just civil servants, but actual policemen were at my home group. So, I did have all these employment assistance programs that had started up. And so I did have a sponsee that was, you know, sort of, he wasn't just a fireman. He was an officer. He was in charge, you know, on a certain level. And he moved up. And he used to take me to the firehouse. And he would tell me, don't mention anything, you know, how you know me from. There's an anonymity. And then he started taking me down to Lafayette Street, where there was a building on Lafayette that was used, now it's the Metro Center, but that the EAP program, you know, so it was nice to, it was an AA meeting, and maybe, you know, it was like a hospital institution one, but, you know, all these things. No, there was definitely public information and cooperation with the professional community, so there's never a, you know, fair section of alcoholics that we still need to touch, people and professionals and other agencies. And so that's the question, you know, that we were trying to attract all the alcoholics and public information and CPC. So my group had all those commitments. Matter of fact, I share this with you. I was a terrible general service rep, right? You go wherever that meeting was, and I didn't know what to bring back to the group. I what did I hear? My mind was always so distracted. But when I became a hospital institution rep, the next 2 years, they believed in the rotation, spiritual rotation. That I did well with. And I stayed with that, even though I wasn't the rep meeting for the Canarsie group. But I rotated out. I did a lot of commitments. And I got to speak at a lot of other commitments, because that's what happens. It opens the door. So I got to go up to Sing Sing one time in the Metro North Employment Assistance Program. There was a meeting there, which was an AA meeting. They're in the books. And the man said, come next week and I'll take you up to Ossining. What's an Ossining? But when he said the name Sing Sing, but you know me, all week my gut was, what the hell am I going to, and I was never incarcerated, so, what does it mean? AA offers you, I think we'll never be able to do everything, me and you, in Alcoholics Anonymous, but, you know, it's nice to try to do some of it. Anyone who's done everything, I think, run away from them, because, you know, yeah, still doors open that I could, I was a public information also in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, Canarsie group. That was very interesting to be part of. So the group was involved.
I know earlier you touched on your experiences in the treatment facilities. So did any of them use the 12-step format or incorporate AA meetings into their structure?
There was, at early 90s, single-room occupancies. Okay. And we went and made, in those facilities, maybe a handful, a presentation about Alcoholics Anonymous. So right. Usually when you go in, but we don't know what, you know, we bring literature. So I guess part of their, you know, hoping to tell them to go to open meetings, you know, see if Alcoholics Anonymous will work for you in that community. And yeah, stuff like that. So if a hospital like St. Mary's had hospitals and institutions on Atlantic Avenue, they had a meeting, but the meeting was a group. And the group is still Alexis from Baldwin Group. She told me her home group is that one in Atlantic Avenue. I don't know the name of it. So,
when you first got sober, how did AAs interact with the media? Have you had any profound experiences sharing your relationship with alcohol with the public, like you were discussing before with your experience up in Sing Sing? What cautions might you have for young AAs today regarding media exposure?
Well, I remember 10 years ago, I was at the Unity breakfast, and someone came up to me. I don't know, I was on the committee. I don't know if I chaired it. And they asked me, do I know so-and-so, because they're my face group friend. And I knew there were, like, Sober Voices meetings, or there were Modem to Modem was coming up. You know, we already, you know, had talked about that. And but that surprised me. So I think they're... Like last year at the Unity breakfast, not in Brooklyn, there was a group of people taking pictures. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it wasn't my place. I told them, as the chair, point out who the chair is, and they can talk to them about that they're taking pictures. The young people, too. You know, they kind of break anonymity. Matter of fact, they're doing a fundraiser recently for Dr. Bob's house, and our group, One Day at a Time, we realized... The flyers are out, but it's for Dr. Bob's house. Is it AA? But it's really a fundraiser. When they're making the announcement in the secretary's report, it says you could buy, you get an extra ticket for $20, like an extra card. And it's going to be questions about
Dr. Bob's house or, you know, history. But we realize next year we won't endure something like that. So we got to be careful. And one year at this Share a Day out here in St. Joe's, the young people put up scholarship, and it was, but it was really a fundraiser. We made them take it down. So it's sneaky. People think, it's AA. It's not hurting AA, but, you know, we got to be careful. Like 50-50 raffles or fundraisers. So groups are autonomous. So there is always going to be, if you break one tradition of the 12, you're really breaking all of them. So, and then we need to talk to people, you know, lovingly about that. And there was a man in last 3 weeks ago, he's a family member, and someone put the basket, and we do read it. And anyway, in front of everybody, someone's speaking, and I'm tussling with the basket, and I finally gave it. I said, listen, but at the end of the meeting, I tried to talk with him and give him back the 20, and anyway, it wasn't going to happen. He started sobbing about his the woman who shared was his niece, and she made mention of Johnny, but Johnny overdosed. So he had to have a niece that celebrated, so they want to give $20. But we try not to let those things, we support ourselves. We're self-supporting. Yeah, so I live by the traditions. I try to teach the traditions to other men, too, if they want to go through them.
Let's move then into service aspect now. You know, let's move into that. And how and why did you get into service work? You mentioned you started out as a GSR. How and why did you get into it?
What you freely received, you freely give. There was also a pamphlet, Why Are We Chosen? I've been reading it lately, you know, on the day of your profession of AA, of your admission of powerlessness and to turn your will and your life over to my keeping. So I still have that. You put numbers on it. So it was just these things that somehow, you know, spiritually, you know, that's what this really is. It's just not running on my own willpower here and trying to freely give back what was so freely given to me. I think we're still trying to pay the debt even though it's so many years later. So,
what contributions did you yourself make to the growth of the fellowship? What do you feel in your service work that you did, you know?
Well, I have a guy who's he's about a year less than me, and I still sponsor him. We might not talk all the time, so sponsorship was important. You know, there's a lot more failures than successes. Did he pass on? A lot of people make fun when I go out. He doesn't believe in God, and he doesn't really practice the steps, but that's okay, you know, that people don't pass on. We take the time, the investment. What else? And the people I mingled with, the network of those few guys, were also into service like I was. You know, they might not have the same group as me, but we had this common peril, as they say, but we have a common solution. So it's all different, personal. You know, me and Joe, we have different, you know, way we're practicing our 12 steps and the way we're doing service. And that's it. You try. I went through voids of not really giving anything back, you know, in AA. You know, just I did celebrate every year because I knew it was for the newcomer. But I did have gaps of doing, you know, I'm like that. I turn off, I turn on. Yeah, I just seem to. But this is the longest I'm consistent, these 16 years of my recovery. Of all the, when I met my wife, I can't do many things, you know, so I started dating and I realized, you know, I fell in love and AA took a little hiatus and sponsees didn't like that and they were concerned I was going to drink and I loved it that, you know, yeah, you know, they were, the love that was poured into us. I always still have that. Love comes from outside me and need that from AA, you know, the love I don't have for myself. Is thank God for the fellowship. You know, that powerful we.
Very true. What about some of the assemblies and conventions early on when you were GSR? Did you attend area assemblies?
No, like I said, I was in the other fellowship, so, you know, they had one every year, you know, and then. But as far as the general service structure and the upside down triangle, that's more now the last 16 years. The sponsor I have, not only is my sponsor, he's my service sponsor. And when I first met him, I offended him because he was never at the Baldwin Group business meeting. And he always announced himself that my home group is Baldwin Group. Right. And then I started, somewhere with more Big Mouth, I apologized. And I realized he, an intergroup, he was, And then I didn't know he's a delegate. And yeah, I thought he, we bowed down to them. But I'm.
What was your impression of AA Trusted Servants? And you actually, this was a good segue into this question because you mentioned meeting a delegate. GSO staff, trusted servants, delegates, you already covered that first encounter. What about general service office staff?
Okay, so it was on Park Avenue South. And that's another thing I loved, is being that I was in Manhattan, I would go and buy literature. And the building, on. It was Park Avenue South. I never knew at that time they said that it was already in a couple other places, but I loved it. I didn't go on a tour, but then once it moved up to where it is now on Riverside Drive, and I've been up to here. So, I'm interested. I read Passing On and Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Before I even read the big book, I used to just read the back of the story. It's not because I'm Jewish.
Oh, and I want to share this too. Yeah. Old timers intimidated even my friends, right? And so I was happy they had time, believe me. But it was to tuck my head out, and I'm amazed that now I'm an old timer, long timer they call them. And I don't see myself that way, but sometimes I look back and I was really intimidated. I don't know if people lie. I don't hear anybody. And it wasn't like I told them that, but I just kept away from them.
Describe, as a personal note, as Nassau County General Service Archivist, I've seen your names on a lot of documents for committees and stuff. So describe your committee activities over your years of service.
Well, I got to say, I really enjoy planning. What happened was, so it's got to be maybe like 12 years ago, I was an alternate rep, a GSR rep for Baldwin Group, and the man wasn't able to make it. And Marie, who was, there's a thing called Long Island Spirituality Through Service, and they asked, Ira B. was the DCMC at the time, and he asked that someone couldn't make it, and can you go to Queens Intergroup and just bring back information, we'll talk to you after the meeting, what to do, right? And so I went, representing Nassau County. And that was it, I finally again got that itch for service like I did in Canarsie, in public information, planning. We used to talk after public information, which is a healthy thing to do, is what did we do right, but yet what did we do wrong? We would do not wait weeks later or for the monthly committee. We felt that we should talk about the experience before it rubs off and we forget. So and that's it. And then from there, you see my name, the Unity Breakfast, and then you rotate into other positions. We just switch seats, and the same thing with lists because each county will host it. There's four counties, so just on and on. Public information, we did something for the bus poster, while it was DCMC. That's got on 25 buses. We put two on each bus. That was a long, I was impatient. It took about 6-7 months to finally go back and forth between the intergroup reps meeting, and we only met every 2 months. So Marty, are you talking for everybody else? People can say that. My impatience. And what else is hospitals? I always loved speaker exchange. I waited for people in my group to not take every one of them, but when they weren't taking them, 16 years ago, I started doing the meetings. Or if there were two or three, sometimes we went out five people, and then we pick who's going to lead it and two speakers. If we didn't have enough, the group, like the old days, the one of the members of their group either opened it or they were the other speaker. Because open meetings, you need three speakers. So it's a lot of fun about this whole thing. The general, another thing, general service conference, the hospitality committee, and the delegates' friends come in, and Bill, introduced me to that one.
Yeah, and I remember you were, when I first started on general service, you were actually the outgoing DCMC.
Okay.
I think you were the last meeting or two before you were ending your rotations. Anything from that? Like, what special occasions do you recall during your time of service? Anything you can think of happen?
Well, you know, I still hold my head high about that bus post. Because, you know, I always was interested in, you know, I went to diversity meetings in Brooklyn. I went to a lot of the ghetto meetings, we call them, or black meetings, Afro-American meetings. I've been the only white person. People didn't come back with me the next week, you know, the people, you know, they weren't interested. I'm not saying it was racism, you know. But, and then the Spanish, when they started going in, I was the corrections chair. Jim M. was also for intergroup corrections. And we went up to Maine, Portland, Maine, and we traveled with a friend that he had come. We picked him up at that Dunkin' Donuts, a little small gas station on the Grand Central Parkway. And woo, you know, we went up all the way to Portland, Maine. That was a long ride. You couldn't talk, you know, with people. Yeah. Even when I went with JR to the New York State Information, we went for one day. We stayed for 3-4 hours, 7 hours in the car. You're going to get to know each other. 7 hours home. You know, what else? I mean, so there's... You know, they called those the roadhouse road meetings. You know, you get in the car. Even Canarsie Group did that. They had commitments out. I don't even remember. We would go places in Long Island, and I could never remember how to get back there. But when I moved out here, I started thinking about that, that they would get 2 carloads, and we'd go out and speak. They didn't tell you who was speaking. So there's a lot of aspects to AA, but the service, you know, it's just a beautiful thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there anything you regret? Any mistakes you believe you made? Any plans that failed that you wish had been successful?
Well, I think about this one a lot, is injecting my personality. I do have an individual personality, but the character defects. You know, there were times in my period that, there was times my sponsors that I had them, each different one, was we didn't really work on, asked God to remove, it says 7, asked him to remove our shortcomings. It really didn't happen until I had 12 years sobriety in 2000. I moved out here. And the man, for the first time, even though it was the big book, but it didn't matter, you know, because I see that. And even after doing that, Joe, with this guy, Howie T, is still how my power, you know, even going into, you know, spiritual fellowship, is, you know, it's the tongue. This little, small little muscle. You know, and so I didn't always apologize to people, but I did let people rent space in my head because I never want to think I had a part in that, you know. Yeah. So I want to say this with you. Even Mary R., there were times, you know, I felt like certain people would like, did they not give our brains for talking? And somehow they overpowered me. But I'm noticing there has to be a change in my life because I enjoy, you know, when Mary and me are in our presence, and it's not like she makes me feel weak. I don't know, you know, I would never share that with her, even though I had sponsors to talk. But the other day, we even spent an hour on the phone, and just, nothing. She gave me like something about library resources by opening up and not cutting it short, and not really getting those little snippets that people like shoot barbs at me. I'm going to avoid them, but I'm stunting my own growth. That's my defects. So once you're in front of the room or you're learning your service response to everybody, you know, you have to 10-step. I find this. The 10-step is so important. Even Danny and Billy, I'm doing years ago I did the book separately with them. But is it them? Or no, I'm learning how to handle situations. A calmer, pausing, not drifting or all of a sudden getting... I don't know, it explains, but you take, you're concentrating on reading a book, but you're bringing in everything else, which are distractions. So, but I can do that today and allow someone, that's their personality. You know, that's their, doesn't mean it's wrong, it's their individual personality, and you love on them. You know, I don't have to walk away, you know, feeling all, you know, knotty or heady, you know, both. You know, my stomach's got a knot, my head is twisted. I can't make sense of what happened here. Two people get together with egos or something. So, yeah, I think that's... So being all these different commitments, you know, so you try to pause. You don't have to say everything that comes to your mind. If you have an active brain like me, you know, he has to engage and reacts, you know, instead of just slow, you know, listen, calm. That's, you know, compassion. T- tolerance, patience. These aren't always kindness. You know, they're not easy, what they call watchwords. And they do happen. But I think it's more the 10th step. I really believe that's the forgotten step. That if we, my sponsor, 2010, told me he passed away. I only need 4 pages in my big book. He said, those are pages 10 and 11. And because you need to practice that, Marty. Yeah. And yeah, so we used to go on retreats. And what did I do for a whole year? I carried all that baggage into, you know, I didn't, you know. And then I thought because I was on the retreat, I gave it away. We burned it in a garbage pail, you know, throw your stuff in there. I was still attached to it because it's here. The neck is carrying all the weight of my shoulders. And my neck is, my head is on the weight of my shoulders. So I've learned to, you know, really slow recovery. But thank God, I'm even working with my brother now. I mean, 12 steps, but the 12th step. And the same thing, I know 5 years he didn't talk to me. And now he's talking to me again for a couple of months. I got to be careful because I know one tirade can ruin a whole relationship. But we are a lot alike. We sound alike. We came from the same family. But I've learned to work on mine. And he gets annoyed by that, knowing he's still like a baby boy, you know. So, but I'm being... But I am, you know, that's what you learn. God brings things back around. And if you really have worked on yourself, you know, I like Bill D says it in the, Bill said, by finding God, he found himself. So God is there. But when you're playing God, you know, it's a lot, you know, there's no growth, I think, in that. You're not working on the character defect, you know. So that's it, you know. I don't know what else answered that.
Yeah. I think you did. How has AA changed, if it has, since you first found it?
That big book. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a big book thumper, but the young man who was 10 years younger than me was in my network, and I was getting ready to move by November of 98, we were going to move, but he was coming to my house and talking about prayers and a big book, and he didn't wear his hat to the side, and he was speaking different. And he said, when you move out to Long Island, there's no big book study in Brooklyn, you know, and that was 1998. So, you know, this big book revival, you know, has really been something, you know, that people, it is the text of the program. So what else? You know, there's a lot more young people and they're on fire, you know, not meaning if they break traditions, but they are practicing the traditions, you know, really interested in it. They have a sponsor. So there's a, I don't think there's enough diversity in Long Beach, or even if you look at the Unity Breakfast, we get one Spanish table. Then there are a small amount of Spanish, but there's not that many Afro-American. You get their table, you know, for some reason, Long Beach, you hardly ever see, and even one day at a time, there's hardly ever, you know, once in a while, there'll be Afro-American. But it's very strange. It's an equal opportunity disease, so it's an equal opportunity recovery, but I don't know why that's the case. I think it was more in Brooklyn. I think we saw more diversity. Canarsie was becoming a, you know, which is probably more now, you know, an Afro-American neighborhood, but yeah. Something out here in Long Island, I don't know what it is.
Yeah. Do you see any particular changes in the service processes since you're starting service?
Well, I think some people skip from like greeter or coffee maker, and they want, you know, all of a sudden they want to do H&I, or they want to, you know, I think there is a spirit of rotation to things, you know, and slow recovery, you know, that you'll get to maybe your network of people, you realize they're doing H&I. So you wanna, or you went in and you spoke at South Oaks, or it doesn't mean that because you are an alumni at South Oaks, you need to chair that meeting. You know, no, right? That's how AA is. You know, it's you know that you don't have to. I went to the jail, so now there's also you have to wait to go to the jails. But a lot of people want to go back in. You know, is their motives right? That's what I'm trying to say. You know, because. You know, your motives are to do 12-step work. They always emphasize when we're going to speak in a hospital, an institution, a psych ward, we're trying to tell them what AA is doing for us. And instead of getting them to thirst for a drink, a lot of us think we tell our war story, you know, but we're really not attracting as an intergroup, you know, there's meetings in your neighborhood, what AA can do for you. You know, that's what we're supposed to attract them. We think by sharing our drunkalogue, that's the attraction. And then they come here and they think that's what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Are there any strong similarities in the AA fellowship and its history of service from your own service experience?
I wanted to say this. Just because you sponsor a lot of guys, a lot of men don't 12-step sponsor. They don't do that, you know. And also, they don't get involved in service. You know, they don't go out where there's, like, the commitment for a general service rep. Or you ask them to come, you know, invite them to do something. Just come along. Just check it out. You know, whether it's the assembly. And they think I'm like, you know, oh, that's great, Marty. You do so much, Marty. But how did I start out? Someone asked me to come. They invited me. And reluctantly, I say yes. You know, I wanted to say no, but because I did say no. So that's what I find. That on the home group level, sometimes they do complain about the business meeting. We go on and on. And I tell them I went through that too. It's seasoning, you know, and it can still crop up about complaining. You know, you leave the business meeting mad and resentful in the car now, you know. But you got to keep coming and work through that because you got to offer the AA. It says we have to contribute to where we go. Look to what I can contribute, not what I can get. And I try to share. But a lot of people don't pass this stuff on. I mean, they might do jail commitments, but they're not sponsoring. They're not, you know, it just looks good. They get speakers. They do things. But it starts in the home group. Alcoholics Anonymous is definitely the family. No matter how many days a week your home group meets. It's not comfortable seeing people all the time. In more days a week, you have your home group, right? Because we have people like to take the focus off of us and know better what they need to do than I do. So that's another thing. Try to get your sponsors to stop. Stop. Oh, what's this saying? Like the other day I was with someone. Oh, everyone in the world does that. No, don't think like that. When you start thinking that everybody does that, you're acting out. Or you're a step away from acting out, not a step from, you know. But yeah, you gotta try to rid yourself of certain thoughts. Yeah, you have to ask yourself, you know, stay in your lane. What is it, you know, that bothers me? Not justifying that the world does that. Yeah. So.
This concludes the oral history. On behalf of Nassau County General Service Archives, we want to thank you for allowing us to record this. Your story will now be a part of our history.